This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 8th of October, 1951. The title of this lecture is The Logics. This lecture is 64 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
You will find, as we go through these axioms, material occasionally that isn't completely clear to you. Very possibly, when you go back home, if you go over it and start observing pre-clears and effort processing, if you're the kind of a fellow that does any thinking, you'll run into the rest of it, you poor fellows. Because I am not even going to essay to take you on a full grand tour. Because it starts at zero and it ends at zero. There's a mathematical proposition known as backing up into zero. We have a zero. Obviously, it is nothing. And so we keep taking things out of the nothing. So we find out that that zero is actually an infinity. Now, this is a fairly well-established principle. That's what we're doing with theta. It's interesting that a fellow by the name of Dirac postulated once upon a time that there were holes in space. A fellow came along, atomic scientist not too long ago, and started bonging a few alpha particles around, and it was weird, but he found out that he was getting two electrons where he should have only have been getting one. That is to say, he was manufacturing an extra electron every time he went through this process that he had embarked upon. So he studied it, and he studied it, and he studied it, and finally he had to conclude that there was a hole in space. Happened fairly recently. The law of the conservation of energy seems thus to have been violated for the first time. Theta might be likened to a hole in space. Theta is merely a mathematical symbol. We have backed up to this hole in space. Now we know what lies just on the other side of the hole. Just a millionth of a millimeter on the other side of the hole, we know what's there, looking back into this universe. But there's where we are. As a matter of fact, I can take a pre-clear to that hole. Not much trouble. Pushing him through is something else. I suppose someday some poor luckless devil will get pushed through and that will, he'll probably vanish. But that's all right. It's all for the cause of science. Oddly enough, theta has, one, no weight. Two, no wavelength. Three, no size. So it's zero, obviously. Only it's not zero. Because as long as we've been playing with theta, it has consistently produced answers. So obviously it isn't zero. Yet, if you just look at this proposition, you go back on the time track to your boyhood or girlhood and break a toy. Do that in theta. Go back and break a toy. Then come up to present time and go find wherever that toy was hidden away as a keepsake and show me that it is now broken. And I will abandon the postulate that theta has no wavelength. Now, here was an experiment we conducted here one night. Here is a piece of chalk. I'm going to put that piece of chalk, right here on the microphone. I want you all to look at it very carefully. And now, I want you to close your eyes and look at it very carefully. You put the chalk back together again, didn't you? And yet here it is broken. Theta is not traveling in the physical universe. Time, as such. Memories are not stored as electrical charges with wavelength. They are not stored that way. They couldn't be. Here's a very funny thing. This fellow been going along fine, his body not deformed at all. All of a sudden, one day, he has a sad occasion there to Roy's mother-in-law's cross to him or something, and keys in an engram. Boom. And after that, he goes around this way. Goes to an auditor. Auditor audits out that charge, and then audits out that engram, and he goes around, and he's all right again. That's peculiar, isn't it? That's very, very weird. He carried, you might say, the potential of this charge all those years without it being keyed in. The amount of energy contained in one of those charges is tremendous. It's not stored in any cells. There isn't a condenser or other electrical apparatus with storage of this much energy known. Nor even could there be a catalyst which would take a facsimile which was lying on the time track and turn it into that much energy. You can watch a fellow running through an incident where he's stuck in the arm with a needle. You'll see the flesh sink. He hasn't got any muscles to make it sink. But it sinks. I found out how to turn a theta facsimile, that is to say a memory recording, on full. A short time ago, broke out a tooth. Somebody was asking the next day if they thought I would mind if I showed them the tooth. Well, I'm sorry I can't do that because the tooth was broken so badly I had to pull it. Wasn't even left of it. Second molar. Very strange that it was cracked on the side. Very peculiar. There were no cells around to make that tooth crack. It couldn't crack internally by a convulsion inside itself in some peculiar fashion. Here's theta facsimile. These and various other data bring us to understand that when we travel back in theta, we are not traveling back in mess. You could figure it out that the body has a set of cells, and these cells start out at conception and somehow or other carry these memories as a lasting trace and all of this sort of rubbish. Funny part of it is that everybody every 7 years, there isn't a single native cell left in the body. About 7 years does for every cell in the body. They're all changed by that time. Most cells are changed in the body in a matter of months. So these memory recordings aren't passed along from cell to cell. They could be. They could be, but they're not stored as electrical energy. You start examining this any way you want to, and you find out that there isn't an energy in the physical universe, at least which we know about, which is small enough to store a memory recording. Oddly enough, this was a discovery of 1932 when I was taught molecular physics at George Washington University. Made an exhaustive study of the matter. There aren't wavelengths small enough. Your physical scientist would know that. The boys fooling around in medicine would not know it, because they would not know the laws of energy. As a consequence, they have postulated as the best postulates which they can offer. A fellow over in Vienna says that memories are stored in punched protein molecules. That's cute. 10 holes in a molecule. He doesn't say what punches them. And something like 100 memories to a hole. And then you figure that there's 10 to the 21st power binary digits of neurons in the body, figure out how many molecules there are and how many memories this is, and you find out that the human body, on this incredible theory, will not store 3 months' worth of perceptions, even if you look at the biggest, only the main observations. Wonderful. Punch protein molecule theory is wonderful from this standpoint. You can't see a molecule by any existing energy. Today, an electronic microscope will give you a vague impression of the whereabouts of a molecule, but that's about all. You can't look at molecules. They draw beautiful pictures of them in chemistry, but they don't look at them. They're small. They're very small. Tiny. Wavelengths of light, wavelengths of electricity, wavelengths of radio, or anywhere on the spectrum, supersonics, the black band, anywhere, up and down, are much, much too gross to form a recording mechanism such as we know in the physical universe. This is all astonishing data. This is all known to a physicist. You start to examine theta, he'll find out immediately that theta is having a tough time sweeping along in present time continually. And it's sweeping along in present time continually, and it's only in present time continually, and only can be returned back to through present time. Your preclear doesn't go any place. He's lying right on the couch in front of you. In addition to that, the numbers of people turning up with experiences post-mortem demonstrate utterly that you're not dealing with a genetic line. Well, we don't need that proof. All we need to look at is just this phenomenon of return. You look at the fact that the person is returning back through his memories. You watch a preacher on the couch turning back through his memories, you could watch such manifestations as his back suddenly sinking in. You can watch him being twisted all out of shape various ways in manners for which he has no muscle to accomplish. He hasn't any muscles that can accomplish many of these actions which you will see. You can take a preclear and by restimulation in full of some engram, you can make him sit with his hands and his feet off the floor in an unbalanced position, which he could not maintain no matter how much you coax him to maintain. Wonderful. There's a lot of this experimental data. You can research it all you want to, but it all boils down to this one fact. I don't want to have to belabor it. Matter of fact, I'll probably lecture about 20 hours just on this one factor. Theta has no physical universe wavelength. It doesn't have any time in it, so therefore it can't have any wavelength. Wavelength is a measure of motion through space against time. So something that doesn't have any wavelength doesn't exist. It says it doesn't exist. It doesn't have any mass. It doesn't have any of these things. And it's very funny that the more we play with this stuff called theta, the more answers we get. So we can postulate that we are looking up to a certain point in the physical universe. Below that point, all is motion. And above that point, all is question mark. And it's certainly not motion in the physical universe, but it may be motion in its own universe. This we don't know about. But this is a good, solid, practical physicist method of looking at something. We cannot identify this. Therefore, let's see what we can rescue out of what we can't identify and classify it against what we know, and with that work problems. One of the most practical approaches that physics has evolved is that principle. Back up into the unknown, use what you've got. So here we have a lot of phenomena sitting around here in the physical universe, evidently, but it's not in the physical universe, more or less, but it is in the physical universe because there are living organisms here in the physical universe. With what you are in contact, I can't tell you, but that you're in contact with something, I can assure you. Your theta facsimiles are fascinating. They are facsimiles of the entire environment where everything occurred. They are recorded in the most bounteous fashion imaginable. Everything gets recorded with them. About 80% get recorded with these facsimiles. And when they re-stimulate and reimpose themselves upon a human being, they evidently do so on an atomic and molecular level. They produce a misalignment of the molecules and atoms which go to make up the structure. Or they produce an alignment in that. They aren't as gross, you might say, as joints, as the whole body, but are particularized to every portion of the body, but are evidently neither residual within or without the body. They just exist. Where, how, that we're not questioning at this moment. That's the second echelon. So I give you a definition of the departure we are taking when we examine Dianetics. We're examining physical organisms in the physical universe obeying a manifestation about which we know a very great deal. And we're watching that manifestation as it works with and influences motion. In doing this, we've cracked the riddle of human behavior. We've got the full circle now. The full circle. We can take anything out of this. I'm giving you that as a preface, which really should be a preface on the logic section of this book. Dianetics, as anything new, started out with a way of thinking about things. It presents its way of thinking about things as postulates. What it is here is logic postulate one. Now, one doesn't argue with a science's postulates about logic. The fellow working in the science says, we are thinking about it in this fashion. This seems to produce validity. By this method of thinking about it, we can isolate phenomena and in this fashion be able to examine the physical universe better. Thus, these axioms. We're not worrying about whether these axioms are true or false. The first thing we want to know in these axioms is about definitions. I don't think anybody, perhaps somebody has. Yes, I'm sure somebody has, but perhaps before this, there hadn't been a definition of definition. What did one mean by definition? The consequence, somebody like Kraepelin in psychiatry could come along and catalog all of an enormous array of what he called insanities and insane manifestations, and he defined each one. And when he got all through, he had a beautiful system of classification which was meaningless. The reason it was meaningless is because it did not spot cause or effect. It didn't designate a cure. All it did was describe. Therefore, how does one describe things? Certainly, if we're examining phenomena, we should know how to describe things. So there has to be a definition for definitions. What are definitions? What are we going to accept as a valid definition? Is what this asks bluntly. And here are all the ways, I think, perhaps there are others, but these are the principal ways of defining things. The first is descriptive definition, one which clarifies by describing existing state of being by characteristics. We say, table. It has a flat top. It sits on the floor. It has four legs. Now, we have a differentiative definition, one which compares unlikeness to other entities. Table. It has four legs and a high top, unlike a chair, which has a low top and four legs. It is made out of wood, which means it is different from this microphone. Differentiative definition. Associative definition. One which declares similarities to the state or object being defined. Table. A piece of furniture. Now that's the kind of definition for a table. And again, a dynamic definition, one which delineates cause and potential change of state of being by cause of existence, action, or purpose. Table. You use this thing to put things on. It sits on the floor and it's a piece of furniture. Sometimes people sit on it, but not always. And you build them by putting four legs together and putting the top on. And you take them apart with an axe if you have to. That tells you what tables are for. Tells you what you do with tables. Now of those definitions, the last is the valuable one. No definition which does not give cause, use, or solution inherent in itself is worth a darn. Any science which pretends to be a science and uses these other three is a hoax. It doesn't know. It says measles. Face gets covered with blotches. Temperature goes up. Measles. Schizophrenia runs around halls and screams. Now, from the full knowledge that these definitions are inadequate, there can be a high authoritarian attempt to make these definitions designate a wisdom in the field which does not exist. You take Latin and Greek phrases, you put them together into inarticulacies, and apply them to all sorts of things, similar and objects and so on. And when you get all through, you have something that sounds like a Latin chant, but it still will be nothing but a descriptive definition, a differentiative definition, or an associative definition. No matter how much language or complexity goes into a definition, it cannot thereby become a dynamic definition. A true science has within its embrace, then, dynamic definitions. If you are trying to define something because this has use for people, because this is a system of logic, not unlike other systems of logic which have been put forth into the world a few times, it's all by itself. It's relatively unimportant. It depends upon many other systems of logic which have gone before, but it's a clarification of them. But it's distinct to itself, and that is codification of how we are going to think about this subject. So if you're going to describe something, know that your description will be inadequate unless you delineate with that description cause, purpose, and solution. Then you can communicate, and only then can you communicate. To try to communicate by perception alone is inadequate. You know you have a definition then, if it'll answer this last one, a dynamic definition. Cause, purpose, solution. If it's got these things, then you're saying something. Otherwise, it's just words. So, Dianetics can be defined as a system of coordinated axioms which resolve problems concerning human behavior and psychosomatic illnesses. It says what it does. It says what it is. It's a system of axioms. It's a whole which do a certain thing, which solve a certain thing. Therefore, that is the definition of Dianetics. Very often, you may have tried to define Dianetics to somebody and given them a descriptive definition of it. Always give them an action definition. They said, what is this thing, Dianetics? And you say, well, you know, it's a funny thing. Down Foundation the other day, and they had a chart there, and you could look on this chart, and Dianetics includes such things as this, and you look on this chart, and you find four or five things that a human being does, and then you can always tell what he'll do in the future. And they'll say, yeah. Yeah, you know whether he'll leave his wife, beat the baby, or any of these things. You know all that in the future, and they got it all on the chart. And anybody can use it, and you just look at it and say, yeah. Gee, I wonder where I am on that chart. You get that kind of a reaction. You've invited a communication. By doing what? By saying what Dianetics is for and what it does. Not by saying it is a system like psychology. Because then they have to understand what psychology is in order to understand what Dianetics is. Well, nobody understands what psychology is, so he's sunk. Well, we go on to the next one. All systems of thought would have a system of logic in them. Even if a system of thought doesn't state what a system of logic is, it inherently has one. Up to this time, an engineering textbook on physics should have included this book is built on three-valued logic. It should have said that in the beginning of the book to have been exactly precise. Yes, maybe, and no. That's three-valued logic. That's more or less what engineering logic consists of. And I say that not because it's less or more workable, because if you asked engineers a relatively short time ago, what kind of logic do you use, they would have said three-valued logic. And you'd say, well, what kind is that? And they'd say, well, you know, just like Boolean algebra. That's the way the brain works, Boolean algebra. They had it all figured out. Now, in Dianetics, we introduce infinity-valued logic. You've probably all seen this. It's in the notes and lectures. I go over it very briefly in order to give you just a little review. Here we have right. Here we have wrong. Here also we have infinity. Here we have infinity. Here we have to come. Here we have survive. Here we have me. It's not whether something is right or wrong in Dianetics. Is it righter or wronger than something else? All values of logic are relative to something. Every datum has to be evaluated by another datum. So, the mind more or less thinks on this basis. It gets a question, and then it compares it to the material universe, and it says, well, that answer is 2 units wrong. Now it gets another datum, which is 5 units right. Then it gets another datum, which is 6 units, makes this solution 6 units wrong. So you come over here, the fellow mind adds it up and says, look, that's pretty wrong. We won't do that. All data is being evaluated as it comes up to the computer in this fashion. This is thought. These are done by the introduction of theta facsimiles of data in the physical universe. Theta facsimile of data in the physical universe compare, recombine, and so forth, and give solutions which are righter or wronger. Something was really pushed off on us with Hegelian grammar that had absolutes in it. The word correct, the word accurate, the word right, the word wrong. These are all back there and impinged upon our good old Aristotelian logic, to which our old friend Korzybski, God rest his bones, objected so violently but supplanted with so little. Now, old Korzybski introduced the data behind axioms of logic of this type, where general semantics applies to Dianetics is it's a shadow background to these existing axioms on logic, not on thought. It doesn't go further on thought. Very valuable, though. Don't let anybody tell you, though, that general semantics and Dianetics are similar. They're just vaguely similar. General semantics has to do with the word and the thing and a lot of other things. We're not worried about Dianetics. We even define words differently. We've got a definition of words. We say, words are theta facsimiles of physical universe action or states of being. All right, there's logic. There's a system of logic. Logic depends on viewpoint. Who is making this up? The United States says, communism.
Well, let's see, there are enough bars here, but that's wrong.
Or in Russia, they say capitalism.
Well, there are enough bars here, but that's wrong.
Well, you can't then say rather thoughtlessly, well, they both think it's wrong, somebody must be right. Nuh-uh, nobody's right, nobody's wrong. There isn't any such an absolute. But there are rightnesses and wrongnesses according to viewpoint. Now you take some pretty clear who has the viewpoint of succumb. He's outward bound to succumb. You try to give him a process which will pick him up and make him survive. Believe me, you're wrong. Somebody is outward bound to survive on that side of the ledger. You give him a process which is going to make him succumb, and you're wrong. All depends on viewpoint. This is a highly flexible system of logic. Quite useful. It has a mathematics. Or 2, or 6, or 12, wrapped up in it. Simple, though. You get over here, you find out that if anybody was absolutely wrong, if you ever reached absolute wrongness, the whole universe would disappear. Because everything in the physical universe is so interdependent on everything else in the physical universe that you can't have an absolute which affects everything in the universe is wrong, because if everything in the universe was wrong, you wouldn't have anything. Over here on the right side, if anybody was absolutely right, such as Pop and Mommy used to pretend they were, the whole universe would become immediately static and fixed forever in that shape. Yeah? These axioms are ultimates along a certain compartmented area, and that's all, and they're right within that area. And I'll show you what that area is in a moment. Now, these axioms don't have exceptions known to us at this time. When somebody whenever it happens, near or far future, finds a new simplicity, a higher echelon from which to branch out, many of these axioms will go by the board. But until a higher simplicity is reached, these axioms are rigidly fixed without exception. It's an unfortunate thing I introduce you to, a lack of randomity in a subject just now. All right, next thing we get is the third logical postulate. A datum can be evaluated only by a datum of comparable magnitude. Should be interesting to you that there's no sense trying to compare the behavior of a nation by the behavior of an ant. There's no sense in trying to tell somebody how big a mountain is by showing him a grain of sand. This single datum postulate is something on which logic and the humanities have been splitting their keels ever since people tried to launch vessels in that direction, the single datum. Originally, they said there was God every time they came up against a higher echelon, which they couldn't resolve. That they'd say, well, and above that's God. You march your evolutionist back to his amoeba and to his ammonia seas and so forth, and you say, all right, now what came before that? And he says, well, God. Just as you asked ancients what caused everything, they had a good, bad answer. They said God. They didn't say the mechanism by which he caused it. Now, this is no invalidation or validation of God. It merely says that they had a single entity sitting up there. How could you evaluate something that only had one datum? With what do you evaluate God? God wasn't very understandable. The Christians came along and gave us the devil. Now we had a datum of comparable magnitude. Now people could be happy. Now we knew what God was. God was an absence of evil. Now we knew what the devil was. The devil was an absence of good. The devil was positive evil. God was positive good. Now we're all set. Now we can interplay these two, and we can extrapolate from there, and we can get an entire system. So they did. It's a highly workable system. True, false, or indifferent, that has nothing to do with it. I'm just showing you how high you can get up along the level, and everybody happens to know this datum about God. Don't ever make the mistake of suddenly postulating on any echelon one datum, because it won't resolve. The basic unit of the universe is two. There is a comparable mathematics to Dianetic logic in Dymaxion geometry, which is a very amusing geometry of how you fill up space. Logic, for is a datum is as valuable as it has been evaluated. And God rest our weary bones, everybody seems to have missed this one. A datum is no confounded cockeyed good in the world unless it's been compared. Now, do you know where that comes from and why there should be any violence behind that statement? People keep coming around and they say, well, you know that phenomenon you mentioned there, so on. They knew about that in mysticism about 3,000 years ago. Everybody's known that straight along. And you say quietly and gently, yes, but it wasn't evaluated. Its relationship to other data had not been adequately established. Well, they don't quite savvy this. The point is that a datum which sits out all by itself in a resounding, heaving sea of data, which doesn't have an evaluation tag on it, is no good to anybody. Unless that person gets himself some sort of a systematized effort that sorts out this data automatically and builds bridges to it. In other words, makes it evaluated. Then the data becomes very valuable. So somebody says, well, Freud already said that there was a pre-birth memory. Nothing new about that. And you say, what did he hang it to? Well, he said so. It was right there in the book. Of course, he also said above and below that 1,000 disrelated things which didn't have any truth in them. He hadn't evaluated this thing, so he hadn't said to a student, what is true about this, or what is false about it? And a student wading through could only then commit it to memory, and he could not use it in the physical universe. If you're going to teach anybody anything, you'd better teach them how valuable their data is. Telling people here the other day about Dutton. It's one of the finest books on navigation you ever wanted to read. I imagine many young officers felt like blowing his brains out at the Naval Academy the moment he ran into Dutton. The reason why is Dutton is a complete monotone of data. It starts in with paragraph one, chapter one, and announces important or unimportant facts in the same tone of voice throughout about a 450-page volume. And you commit it all to memory, and then you get aboard ship, and all you had to find out is you don't wipe the lens of a sextant or something. That was the important datum. That's a fact. And ensigns just almost go crazy with Dutton. But an old line navigator comes along, and he picks up Dutton, he looks it over, and he says, "My boy, this is one of the finest books on navigation you ever want to read." The ensign, bong. Of course it makes sense to the old line navigator. Of course it does. He's got all the evaluations. He knows enough not to wipe the lenses of a sextant eyepiece with a dirty handkerchief and other important stuff. Hey, he knows that it's twice as important to take the sight right as it is to figure it right. And yet you'll find ensigns, all they just go out and they worry and they work and they get their tongue between their teeth and they figure out the position of the ship down to the last breadth of an inch. Only their sextant sight's 20 miles wrong. And you show them this, you say, "Hey, look, why don't you take an accurate sextant sight and knock off those decimal places on that computation?" "But that computation's accurate." "No evaluation of importance. This guy'll run you aground if you don't watch him." "He'll be out there taking a good solid shot at the truck light and come in and report that he's now shot Arcturus and that your position is 10 miles south of Cincinnati." Those are some of the liabilities of not evaluating data in a field. Now, a lot of these axioms over here are necessary in a flow of thought. They flow through. But out of all of these axioms, there are only 8 of them of excruciating importance. I'll point those up when I get to them. But if you're composing a system of logic, if you're trying to study a field of logic, you will mainly be trying to evaluate somebody else's data. If you're having trouble with that field, the only reason you're having any trouble with it is because the data has not been evaluated in it. Therefore, if the data hasn't been evaluated, you know it hasn't been compared to anything, so therefore the field isn't oriented, so skip it. Logic 5. The value of a datum is established by the amount of alignment relationship it imparts to other data. Here is the whole of life in the physical universe can be represented by a cone. Here's a cone. This point of the cone is the high point from which we are viewing other data. So we have here the value of a datum is established by the amount of alignment it imparts to other data. Consider that this cone is filled with random data, all sorts of data. Nobody knows what sits there. The complexity of data becomes more complex as you go down the cone, becomes less complex as you go up the cone. So you look at this point. If somebody can find the datum that sits there at the highest level of simplicity about the rest of this data, that all of a sudden says, the reason ants build houses are, you build ships by, and so on, and all of a sudden you've got this data up here, and it aligns those two facts, then that's a very important datum. Mathematical and logical search is concentrated upon the search for high echelon simplicities, not low echelon complexities. When a mathematician makes a mistake and fails to contribute to the body of knowledge, it's because he cuts in along about there. And you say, "Hey, look, how about getting a solution to this datum and this datum and this datum? That line that you're figuring from there doesn't align enough data." "All right," he says, "all right, I'll figure it out. Let's see, I'll add 25 more equations onto this situation." And then you say, "But look, that doesn't explain all of this data down here. Now, what are we going to do about that?" Well, he says, we'll add about 15 or 20 more equations. And you've got such a complexity that it itself has to be aligned. His direction of approach and your direction in the solution of a problem should be upward towards simplicities, not downward into complexities. There is also a law of an economy of factors. Law of parsimony, they call it. If you have two theories which seem equally valid, take the one which requires less data to support it. Just automatically take the one which has less factors in it. If you want to resolve a case, for instance, we've got a figure like this. A person always tries not to survive. It's no effort to survive. What it's an effort to do is not to survive. That's what's rough. Because you see, that is an effort to overcome efforts which were not to survive efforts. And you get very complicated on that basis. So, all right, you could ask the preclear for the effort of each word in the English language. You could actually ask him for the effort, and he'd resolve it for you. But it'd take quite a while. Now, if we know this law about it's the effort not to survive, which is aberrated, that's the one. All right. Let's ask him simply for what is the effort not to survive? Boom. Let's get the effort on that. And he'll play you all sorts of efforts off on that one. And he'll gunshot out the whole bank with it. This is applicable in therapy. Always take the question which gives you the maximum amount of data in front of you, not the question which gives you the minimum amount. Get the broadest, widest explanation in the least words. Go towards simplicities of explanation, not toward complexity in thinking, and you will find yourself solving a lot of problems which you wouldn't otherwise perhaps crack. It's a good axiom. Not an axiom, it's a postulate. Logic 6, problems are resolved by compartmenting them in areas of similar magnitude and data, comparing them to data already known or partially known, resolving each area. By resolving what cannot be known immediately, one can address what can be known and use its solution to resolve the remainder. That's awful simple. I was just telling you just a few minutes ago about theta. We don't know what there is about this theta. We don't know all there is about it. But we can take what we feel that there is known about it. We know a lot about the physical universe right now because we have the whole science of physics. So let's take where this theta hinges on the physical universe and study it from that quarter, and then resolve that with what we learn. And now, with what we learn there, we'll resolve that. And now, with what we learn this way, we'll resolve that, and so forth. In other words, you don't have to know anything about this. Let's just find out what it relates to, and then solve what it relates to, and it'll solve it. Very simple. It's a method of thought. You can use it, by the way, with considerable profit in thinking. Now, logic 7 is self-explanatory. The introduction of an arbitrary. Anytime you have to throw an arbitrary into a situation to make it work, you're going to have other arbitraries introduced in order to keep it resolved, and it'll just go more and more and more complex. If there's something you don't understand about a case and you decide to use force on that point, you're just going to have to introduce new force factors. You don't know how to resolve a psychotic case, let's say, and here's a psychotic and he's screaming around and so forth, and you say, well, we can't solve this right now, we can't solve this right now, we can't solve this right now, we'll have to do something desperate. So you introduce an arbitrary, give him a sedative. Well, there you go. You're all set right there. Give them a sedative. You've introduced an arbitrary. It'll introduce further arbitraries of what's said in the preclear's vicinity. Now you'll have to give the preclear two sedatives in order to quiet them down next time. And then you'll probably have to give them electric shock, some more sedatives, and then a prefrontal lobotomy. You get the idea of the arbitraries. It's a fan. You introduce one arbitrary into a case, and you'll have to keep introducing arbitraries. So the devil with these quick, simple methods. They aren't quick, and they aren't simple, because they lead to the introduction of further arbitraries. This is also applicable in any system of logic. Any system of mathematics works in this fashion. They pass a law saying all criminals must cease to exist without understanding what criminals are or what criminology is. Well, now they have to pass 100,000 laws, time, year in and year out, in order to force the law that criminals mustn't exist. They go into further and further and further complexities. Now, this system of logic I was just showing you here, the cone going into simplicities, that is driving toward natural laws. As soon as you start to introduce arbitraries into a problem, you just keep going into further and further complexities. It gets tougher and tougher and tougher, and there's less and less alignment of data. And the first thing you know, you've got a completely out-of-vector problem that doesn't align any place. Nobody understands it, and you're a psychiatrist. Don't ever let Dianetics start going in that direction. Logic 8. An abstract postulate must be compared to the real universe and brought into the category of things which can be sensed, measured, or experienced before it can be classified as workable. That is really, actually, just a definition of what we mean by workable. We mean workable in the physical universe. Workable visibly. Workable in terms that we can sense, measure, or experience. There's a lot of data behind that one. Some interesting data. There's such a thing as three bins. Here we have three bins of data. One, two, three. Down here in the third bin, we have what man thinks he knows right now. He thinks he knows how to make good ice cream and shoes, and he can make pretty good cars, and he can make power dams, and he can get women to whistle at him by driving a fancy car. Things known, data. That's what he calls data. Seems to work empirically or by derivation in the physical universe. This data seems to work. So he says, fine. Fine, this data works. All set. Only he isn't, because there's always a randomity of data. Some of these are going to cross, some of them. One of data will argue with another one. He'll decide to go to the movies, but his wife doesn't want to go, and he doesn't want to go without his wife, but he wants to go to the movies. How do you solve it? So he takes up yogi. Well, whether or not it's the science of physics or any other field, I don't care. Metaphysics, mysticism, algebra, democracy, anything. Up here, the second one is composed solely of routes toward new data. It's by these routes that we discover new data from the great unknown. This area may be unknown, but it is not unknowable. Every datum in it is true. Just because we don't know it, there's no reason. But there isn't such a datum that we will never know in there that will have any effect upon us, because if it's never going to have any effect upon us, then we'll never be able to sense, measure, and experience. So as far as we're concerned, it doesn't exist. Kant, to the contrary. Oh, he's a great boy, those boys, Hegel, Kant. I wonder if they didn't get terrible headaches. Transcendentalism. The only real data transcends the bounds of all human experience. Now that we have announced this, the rest of you dogs have to take our word for it. What a wonderful way to get on top and stay on top. And nobody ever thought to ask them, now how is it, Hegel, that you know if it transcends the bounds of all human experience? If you're never going to sense, measure, and experience this, Hegel, how do you know about it? No, he twirled his monocle too well or something. Nobody ever asked him. I would love to know what his answer was. The point is, here's all sorts of data. Here's better ways to make ice cream. Here's better ways to make airplanes, rocket ships, women, everything. It's full of data. And every datum is true. But by the time you get a datum here and pull it down by one of these routes and compare it to the real universe, it's liable to slightly change on you. And you ask, how true are these axioms? They've been dragged out in that fashion. How true are they? They're as true as they are workable. No truer. They work. If they work, then they're workable. But you understand that the Hindu theory of how the universe was created was also considered very workable once upon a time. You know, somebody came up to the priest and they said, look, what is this universe all about? Your boys are supposed to know. They said, well, it's a hemisphere. There you are. Go along now. Went along for a few generations. Everybody was happy with this. And one day, some curious, rebellious, sour individual, probably a communist, came up and he said to the priest, what's the hemisphere standing on? And the priest went into a big powwow and they got together and they figured and they figured and they figured and they figured. And then they proudly released the answer. It's standing on seven pillars. A few generations went by. A capitalist came along. Country changed. The capitalist was a rebel. They were shooting them. He came in and he said, the communists by this time were the conservatives. And he said, what are the pillars standing on? They said, the backs of elephants. Another question, what are the elephants standing on? By this time, the priests were sick of the whole thing, so they said, the elephants are standing on a mud turtle, and the mud turtle is sitting in mud, and it's mud from there on down. Well, that passed for true data once. These vacuums someday, I'm very sure, will be in that category. Right now, they aren't. Right now, they're out so far front that nobody's going to... I'm going to catch up with these things for a while. You'll be arguing about these things in your old age, I'm sure. Anyhow, here's true data. It comes down to these roots, no matter whether they're mysticism, metaphysics, spiritualism, physics, chemistry, induction, woman's intuition, everything, any way you can get data, that's the way it comes. But it always has to be compared to the real universe before you can say, this is a datum. This is a datum which we have found some workability for. Now, you say that. You can say, this is a guess, so long as it remains in an abstract state. There's one of the main things wrong with mathematics and mathematicians today, is they do something and never make this error of putting this foot up here in bin one. Now, they very happily have this foot here once upon a time, see? Now, they add their foot here, and then they put a foot up here in bin one via the root of mathematics, and they forget to keep a foot in each bin. And they pick this foot up, and they put them both up there, and you never hear of them again. They actually do that. They get into the abstract, they forget to compare data to the real universe, and the second they do this, they're done for. As far as their system is concerned, they just get more and more esoteric and so on, and they don't tie anything down. Their theories start shooting out in all directions. Somebody comes along and says, I wonder why that fellow isn't getting any place with the problem. He just took his foot out of here. By the way, this is a useful thing to know, that you can get slogging around in the abstract to such a degree that you don't bother to nail down anything. And when you don't nail something down every once in a while and compare it to the real universe, you can really go adrift. Therefore, I'm going to give you these actions. You're going out and you're going to look at phenomena. You see a lot of phenomena. If you don't find phenomena to compare with them, devil with these axioms. They're too abstract. If you can find phenomena that proves them up, well, you say that's fine. But axioms, rules, data, these things are no good until you can find a comparison in the real universe. When you can find a comparison in the real universe, you can say that's workable and let it pass for the moment. But until you've done that, no abstract postulate under the sun is worth a tinker's doggone. Somebody out here can tell you what is a well-known fact, that the human soul is purple with orange dots. You say, that's fine. Where'd you get that? I got that in a dream. Have these dreams very often. They always work out. You say, show me one. Don't have to. Dreams always work out. Well, you're just in complete closed circle as far as this fellow's concerned. He isn't putting a foot back here. If you say, yes, I can show you one, step over to this voltmeter. Zing, bong, I get this phenomenon. I explain it on the basis that souls are purple with orange dots. Because look at the dial turns a bright purple. Well, and you say, so it does. I'll be a son of a gun. But it still has to be compared to another data like it. And it still has to be evaluated in terms of the rest of the physical universe before it's any good to you. Have you ever met these people who go around with these little items, things that nobody could do without? Data that we must have, like Pike's Peak is 9,000 something or other. Mount Rainier is 14,005 feet. And you'll be having a nice conversation with them, and all of a sudden they'll say, well, the new Chevrolet goes 96 miles an hour. And you say, I wasn't talking about Chevrolet. It says, but it will. Having nice discussion at dinner about things like that. And they said, did you know that Persian cats originally came from Samarkand? You say, yes. You expect them to go on and tell you some sort of a witty anecdote about Persian cats, you know, and sit there and you wait. And they say, and silver costs $9.02 a pound in the Transvaal. I mean, it's wonderful. But you can actually do this, and it's just as silly to get up there into the abstract and then not nail anything down. You know, people kept asking me, there was a famous book that nobody's ever read, except a few people, most of whom went nuts. I wouldn't break it out and give it to people. And the reason I wouldn't break it out and give it to people was all up here, every single bit of it. It's taken 13 years of hard work and experience to get that book down here so you can put one foot in the bottom bin and put a foot in the top bin. That's right. Now we can do that. That's why we have these axioms. But 13 years ago, that book was in full. These axioms almost existed in full, with no root built to them. Nothing here. No root. We had no map. We had no phenomena observed in the physical universe to prove it up. It's utterly fantastic to me that it happens to work out as it worked out 13 years ago. This is just an accident. Complete accident. But here was a philosophic induction, which all of a sudden turned out to have enough data in the known universe to fulfill it. Accident. Shouldn't exist. But that philosophic echelon all by itself, good reading, so's Nick Carter. No bridge built to it. Now you can go out and you can look in the field of mysticism. By golly, you can find more data that is workable and that will point up more phenomena for you. Why? Because a bridge is built to it. You know, you can study Dianetics and then go study psychology, and a lot of it will make sense. It's a fact, it will. In other words, almost anything can happen. Now, I've also covered Logic 9, a postulate is valuable as workable. I mentioned this earlier in the talk this evening. We have not had to predict any phenomena which don't exist in order to give you these axioms. Nor have we had at any time here to neglect existing phenomena. Now, we haven't found anything in this physical universe at the moment which happens to fall outside these axioms. I hope somebody does sooner or later, because this is almost a deadly picture with no randomity in it. I mean, no mistakes, holy cat. Horrible monotony. There must be some phenomena, but what it is, I'm sure I don't know. And in addition to that, these theories really test up like a true science in that they extrapolate. You can take these axioms and you can figure, well, if these axioms are right, then such and such should exist as phenomena. Go look. You'll find it. Logic 10 is a large body of aligned data which has similarity in application, deducible or inducible from basic postulates, may be considered to be a science. You know, as much as the world uses the word science, it's hardly ever been defined. It could be defined as many things, but this is to some degree a dynamic definition of a science. How do you make a science? Well, you get some basic postulates and you induce and compare it to the real universe, and if it's all lined up, you got a science. If that's a dynamic definition of a science, some sciences had better look to themselves. Even chemistry, the old grandpappy of everything that started back in the field of alchemy, is so far out of alignment right now that your physicist, with his postulates about atoms and so forth. He goes into the field of chemistry and he says, "Say, you know, I figured out that in your field so-and-so." They said, "That can't be true. That doesn't work according to our postulates." He said, "Well, it works according to my postulates." And they said, "Well, that's fine. We're getting all sorts of beautiful results according to the postulates of chemistry in the field of atomic molecular phenomena. And they're entirely different than the field of physics. The chemist believes an atom is built in a certain way. The physicist believes it's built in a different way. They're both getting results. And they're both merging closer and closer toward some kind of a goal. And they're still in violent disagreement. That's because they have not aligned their fields according to new known data. They haven't realized the field had to be realigned. As a matter of fact, even basic physics ought to now be realigned. The law of the conservation of energy seems to have been kicked overboard. Now, number 11 is one which should interest you a great deal. The problem of human behavior, psychosomatic illness, mental aberration, the phenomena of life is susceptible to solution. A fellow in the old foundation wrote up to MIT. He wrote a letter to somebody that was very interested, whose name I've guaranteed never to mention in the field of Dianetics, who invented cybernetics. I promised him I would never, he was protested that somebody had mentioned his name in some publication, and so I promised him that we would never use his name in connection with it, so we won't. But he said, any time I hear the word cure, universal, used, he said, I always file whatever I hear about it in a circular file. Very interesting. People would work in a field which they consider unsolvable, isn't it? And yet, that has been true of all of these fields of the humanities. They didn't have logic 11. They didn't believe the solution was there. And as a consequence, never made a steady, solid drive toward it. They just keep monkeying around the edges. If they'd believed the solution was there, they would have laid down a logical pattern, because God knows I'm not the only one in the world who can lay down a logical pattern. Nobody even tried, so they were in a field of complete defeat. And it took the verb of physical science to push into that field in order to bring alignment to it. Logic 12, it is possible to resolve the problem of how life is surviving without resolving the problem of why life is surviving. That's what we mean by the first and second echelon of Dianetics. Here we have, who knows, a hole in space. Who knows? But it's certainly a static line of some sort, which contains a zero, which is an infinity, which is an interesting gimmick. It's data, whatever it is. Now, this up here, I don't know at what level, probably contains a why. It says life is surviving because it belongs to them. And you say, gee, why didn't I think of that earlier? But right now it looks terribly imponderable. Why? Why is life surviving? Why all this effort? Why all these ramifications and so forth? This is a rough one. Why? Well, earlier we had an axiom, a postulate about the compartmentation of problems. This is where the problem of Dianetics compartments. It's how. People in the past kept saying, but why is there this and that, and why is it doing that, and why is it doing something else, and so forth, and why? And occasionally would ask a how, but they never differentiated how from why. As a consequence, they never got an alignment of data, because the why is imponderable. At the moment, why is imponderable? We can answer how. So let's separate the sheep from the goats, the alphas from the betas, and get the field squared up, and just look at how life is surviving. And that's what we're doing this very moment. It's very interesting that only low tone scale people will ask you why. All right.